Hello and welcome to episode 727 of the Our Lady of Fatima podcast. It is my pleasure to be with you this morning. My name is Terrence M. Stanton. We are recording on Tuesday, November 28th, 2023, in the year of our Lord Jesus Christ. Let us begin with the Tuesday prayer to the Blessed Virgin Mary to obtain a good death. O Mary, how shall I die? Even now that I think of my sins and of that decisive moment on which my salvation or eternal damnation depends, of that moment in which I must expire and be judged, I tremble and am confounded. O my most sweet mother, my hopes are in the blood of Jesus Christ and in thy intercession. O comfortress of the afflicted, do not then abandon me. Cease not to console me in that moment of so great affliction. If I am now so tormented by remorse for sins committed, the uncertainty of pardon, the danger of relapse, and the rigor of divine justice, what will become of me then? Unless thou helpest me, I shall be lost. Ah, my lady, before death obtain me great sorrow for my sins, thorough amendment and fidelity to God during the remainder of my life. And when my last moment arrives, O Mary, my hope, help me in the great distress in which I shall then be. Encourage me, that I may not despair at the sight of my sins, which the devil will place before me. Obtain that I may then invoke thee more frequently, so that I may expire with thy most sweet name, and that of thy beloved Son on my lips. Nay more, my lady, but forgive my boldness. Before I expire, do thou come thyself and comfort me with thy presence. Thou hast granted this favor to so many of thy devout servants. I also desire and hope it. I am a sinner, it is true. I do not deserve so great a favor, but I am thy servant, love thee, and a full confidence in thee. O Mary, I shall expect thee. Do not disappoint me of this consolation. At least, if I am not worthy of so great a favor, do thou help me from heaven, that I may leave this life loving God and thee, to love thee eternally in paradise. Today, friends, we are once again going to return to the magazine The Angelus, billing itself as the voice of traditional Catholicism, the December 2023 edition. This is the publication of the Society of St. Pius X. And this article is by Father Ian Palko of the Society, entitled The Forgotten World, The Failure of the Catholic Mission to Aotearoa. And I believe I'm pronouncing that correctly. Aotearoa. It is what is now New Zealand. And it begins with a song of lament that says, where are they now? Where are the friends of former days who once lived in prosperity? The time of separation has come, leaving me desolate. Father Palko starts by saying, legends of a long ago sunken land, Atlantis, have persisted in Western mythology from the time of Plato even to the present. Ironically, though, the last major inhabitable landmass to be colonized, New Zealand, known to its discoverers, the Maori, as Aotearoa, turns out to be part of a massive sunken eighth continent, Zealandia. Polynesian settlers arrive on the shores of Aotearoa, which is the size of the state of Colorado sometime between AD 1250 to 1300. Unlike their often associated neighbors, the Australian Aborigines, these Polynesian Maori built a complex hierarchical culture with a respect for the role of tradition in passing on intricate quasi-religious mythologies and tribal and family histories. They built stable settlements, which relied on fishing, hunting, and agriculture in the verdant lands. The arid climate of Australia provided barely enough for the smaller nomadic groups of Aboriginals who were in that sunburned country, quote-unquote, long before the Maori landed in New Zealand. After the sighting of New Zealand by the Dutch explorer Abel Tasman in 1642, Captain James Cook sailed around the islands in 1769. Intermittent whaling expeditions had contact with the Maori, but it was not until 1815 that the first European settlers arrived, along with Samuel Marsden, an Anglican priest, from the Church Missionary Society. The first Catholics, the Irish couple Thomas and Mary Poynton, settled in Papakawau in the rural northern area called the Hokianga in 1828. It is a vast, heavily wooded land along a massive estuary. Thomas set up a sawmill, making a substantial income, allowing a two-week-long voyage across the Tasman Sea to Sydney, Australia, for the baptism of their first two children. In 1835, Poynton requested the visit of a Catholic priest for his family. The congregation of the Propaganda of the Faith and newly minted Marist missionaries had, in fact, already been discussing plans for a mission to the South Pacific and New Zealand in particular. It was on January 10, 1838, that the French bishop Jean-Baptiste Pimpalier arrived in the Hokianga, saying the first Mass in New Zealand on Octave of the Epiphany, January 13. He would spend 30 years in New Zealand before returning to France, where he died in 1871. Buried in Puteaux near Paris, his mortal remains would return to the Hokianga nearly 164 years to the day after he first set foot on what one author called God's farthest outpost. Despite its initial success, not only with the Poynton family and other Catholic settlers, but especially with the Maori, the mission to New Zealand would, however, fail. A metaphor for the failure can be seen in the little settlement of Hiruama, Jerusalem, in other words, about a day's journey by waka, or canoe, up the Whanganui River, or an hour's car ride up a remote one-lane road. There, in 1892, despite Protestant opposition, Mother Mary Joseph, Suzanne Albert, established a convent and foundling's house, along with a new group of religious sisters, the Daughters of Our Lady of Compassion. The convent and church buildings remain and are used for infrequent ceremonies and as a historical site. Long ago abandoning the habit, the order has had no vocations for a long time, and the last religious sister who lived in Hiruama left years ago. A few of those living there and still practicing their faith occasionally visit the property, an empty shell of what it was or could have been. A visit to the marae, a meeting house of the local iwi, by some group would in years past have drawn out at least a small pauriri, which is a ritual greeting ceremony, with the women singing welcome and men exerting a show of force, then welcoming the party onto the marae. Now a visit to the marae rarely turns up any of the customary hospitality, save the greetings of a few older women, the men nowhere to be seen. The next section is entitled, Where Are the Friends of Former Days? For Monsignor Pimpalier and the Maris, their purpose in New Zealand was to be missionaries. Caring for the European Catholics who had settled there was never shunned, but formed a very remote secondary goal. Thus, soon after the first Mass in the Hokianga on the North Island's west coast, Pimpalier moved across the narrow top of the North Island to Kororeka, later Russell, on the Bay of Islands on the east coast. There he established the seat of the Vicariate of Western Oceania and built a printing house, printing some of the first prayer books, Catholic scriptures and catechism in Te Reo Māori, the Māori language. He became so focused on the mission to the Māori that some of the Marist missionaries he left on other Pacific islands later complained they had been forgotten. According to the report of the bishop, by November of the year he arrived, there were 44 Maori who received baptism, with Pimpalier reporting nearly 5,000 were asking for instruction and the sacrament in the north. The Bay of Islands was a hub of activity. Whaling crew and passenger ships regularly visited the sheltered harbor. The Maori saw some of the worst that Europe was able to offer in the visitors and others who stopped over. As J.D. Lang, an Australian minister, once quipped, with a few honorable exceptions, the Bay of Islands consists of the various refuse of civilized society. Because of these problems and complaints by Maori, in 1833, the British Crown sent an official resident minister, James Busby, who would serve as a diplomat and governor for the British subjects while in New Zealand. To stave off the French interest in the islands, Busby convinced 34 of the northern tribes to make a declaration of independence and form a United Tribes of New Zealand. Later, Busby, who lived across the Bay of Islands from Kororeka in Waitangi, would, along with Captain William Hobson, soon to be governor, oversee the making of the Treaty Waitangi in 1840, widely considered the founding charter of the British colony of New Zealand. The fact of his being French and Catholic served as a particular annoyance to Busby and Hobson, but Monsignor Pompallier had been consulted by several of the Catholic Maori chiefs as the treaty was drafted. While he urged them to be very wary of the British and not to sign anything without clearly understanding it, it became clear that if he were to help the Maori and the cause of the faith, he would have to insert himself into the discussions. Eventually, the bishop joined the discussions, and when it seemed the treaty would be approved, made a direct appeal to Hobson. The result was an added fourth article to the treaty, which modern governments frequently downplay, guaranteeing non-interference for Catholics, Anglicans, and Maori custom. This brought the Catholic chiefs to the table for their signature. The original three missionaries, including Pompallier, Father Louis-Catherine Servan, and Brother Michel Colomban, were joined in 1839 by seven Marist priests, including Father Philippe Viard, future Bishop of Wellington, along with four additional brothers. By 1843, mission stations were established in over 15 different places throughout both the North and South Islands. Pompallier purchased a schooner rechristened Sancta Maria, which flew under the standard of Our Lady, a cross surmounted M with 12 stars around this emblem, as the bishop would travel to visit these missions. It was this schooner that would bring the body of St. Peter Chanel, martyred on the island of Futuna on April 28, 1841, to the Bay Islands, where it would remain for 8 years before being transported back to the Marist Mother House in France. The story of Peter Chanel itself is instructive and somewhat relevant to the New Zealand apostolate, though Chanel never saw New Zealand in this life. The bishop had dropped off the gentle priest on Futuna, nearly 2,000 miles from the Bay Islands, in November 1837. King Nuliki welcomed Chanel initially, and conversions were few, until the son of the king, Maitala, asked for baptism. Seeing this would undermine the role of the king as a pagan priest, a warrior was sent to stop this by whatever means necessary. Musumusu, this warrior, clubbed Chanel to his death. Within a generation, the whole island, numbering around 1,000 people, had converted to Catholicism, including Musumusu, who before his death expressed the desire to be buried on the path to the church, so when walking over his grave, he could be shown dishonor when people went to venerate St. Peter Chanel. Even to this day, the island is almost entirely Catholic, with laws based on Catholic morality and a Hakka-like penitential ceremonial dance of penance for the martyrdom of Chanel. It does seem that Tertullian spoke correctly that the blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church, even in the South Pacific. Similar success was initially seen in New Zealand, with Pompallier reporting that nearly 45,000 Maori had converted by 1843 out of an estimated 75,000 people. According to the first government statistics on Maori and religion, 83 years later, in 1926, however, Catholic Maori, including those with Maori ancestry, numbered about 12,000. At the same point in time, Catholics of European ancestry, mainly Irish, numbered nearly 175,000. Within less than 90 years, the Catholic mission to the Maori had become a failure, and the church in New Zealand was an immigrant church. Our next section is The Time of Separation Has Come. Monsignor Pompallier had much to be praised for in his missionary efforts. At the same time, he was a victim of an unfortunate activist approach to missionary work that contributed to the eventual downfall of the missions, leaving it with a shaky foundation centered mostly around his person. His activism became a point of tension between himself, his Marist companions, and their superior, Father Jean-Claude Collin, SM. That conflict created an understandable zeal for souls, and also the need for a grounding in religious life, became a repeated refrain in the history of Catholic New Zealand and the various religious orders that would land upon its shores, and a repeated point of failure when later Franciscans, Dominicans, and other religious were brought in with an eye towards active works instead of their contemplative vocations. Father Maxime Petit, in an 1840 letter, complained to Father Collin that the bishop's zeal and good heart makes him rush out at all times and do all sorts of things. He looks askance at us when we, more than he does, divide our time between duty to neighbor and to ourselves. In the early days here, Father Appal and I did our spiritual exercises as much as possible at moments we thought that he, meaning Monsignor Pampalier, would not notice. Not that he stopped us from praying, but because on several occasions he reproached us for praying all the time. Maori mythology recounts the history of their people and stories passed down from generation to generation, but focuses on great deeds and actions. Even in explaining origins through parable and metaphor, forces are personified and their deeds spoken of. Thus, it is not surprising that for the Maori, the idea of a Catholic religious life of contemplation and reflection did not seem as important as the active works the missionaries would do. In a sense, the activism of Monsignor Pampalier was a pastoral necessity and one to which he firstly bound himself. He would undertake great journeys himself and burn himself out for those to whom he was sent. But with an emphasis that did not agree with the Marist religious life. Already there was difficulty when then Father Pampalier was in charge of the Marist tertiary brothers before his missionary days, when he gave them the motto, excuse me, be exemplary Christians in public, religious in secret. This was the spirit of the missionary age at which Dom Jean-Baptiste Chartard, OCSO, in his Soul of the Apostolate, would later that century take aim. Our Lord is looking for, above all, is adorers in spirit and in truth, but these activist heretics, for their part, imagine that they are giving greater glory to God and aiming above all at external results, the Trappist monk writes. These difficulties in the approach of Pampalier and Collin developed into a question of jurisdiction. Pampalier, as a bishop and the vicar apostolic for the territory, was the pope's direct appointee and held territorial jurisdiction over the lands in which the Marist missionaries worked. The missionaries, as religious, were subject to their superior general, Collin. As one historian puts it, religious priests were in the schizophrenic situation of belonging to a superior general by their vows, and a bishop by their ministry. The problem was not Pampalier's alone, however. Collin founded the Society for the Missions and tried to imbue it with the spirit which merged the notion of the missionary and religious, but never provided any fixed rules approved by the Holy See for the guidance of the Marists, neither at their founding nor during his tenure as superior general. This tension over the role of a religious as a missionary was not the only complaint about Pampalier, who was not the best judge of character or the best accountant. Severe privations had to be undergone because the good-natured bishop was overcharged on property, or funds sent from Rome and meant for the missions became tied up in failing English banks on the way to the Antipodes via the regular ships sailing from England to New Zealand. In part because of these tensions, but also because of the vastness of the territory of New Zealand and its rapid growth, the Holy See decided to suppress the vicariate and established in the country two dioceses. The territory north of the 39th parallel will become the Diocese of Auckland with Monsignor Pampalier as its first ordinary. The remainder would go to Father Viard, who would become the Bishop of Wellington. Viard, a Marist, would receive all of the Marist brothers and priests under his jurisdiction, and Pampalier would have to get new missioners. Pampalier was in Rome at the time of this decision and quickly worked to secure 11 priests to replace the Marists he would lose upon his return to New Zealand. He also secured several Franciscan friars to come and substitute for the Marists. The Franciscans would stay only a short while, and their work was performed in the midst of the New Zealand wars, land disputes, and actual warfare between the British and various Maori iwi, or tribes. These wars caused great distrust between the Maori and Pakeha, the non-Maori New Zealanders, causing many Christian Maori to form new religious political sects founded on, quote, revelations to so-called prophets. The Franciscans in particular were noted for their intransigent opposition to the Hauhau sect, protecting many Catholic Maori from their influence. The Mill Hill Fathers also were invited in to help in the Auckland Diocese with the Maori missions. The next section is Who Once Lived in Prosperity. The approach of Pampalier and the Maris was very much like the Jesuits in Paraguay. Unacceptable pagan elements of the culture were removed, while the faith was taught and integrated into the existing culture through education. The result was a nascent Maori Catholic culture and church, and a country that had a promise of becoming a Catholic nation, or at least one with a heavy Catholic influence. The influx of settlers, however, eroded the missionary efforts and began to place the focus of the clergy on the Catholic immigrants, mainly Irish. Signs of this changing dynamic can be seen on many fronts, including the liturgy. Monsignor Pampalier had dedicated New Zealand to the patronage of Our Lady of the Assumption upon his arrival. When he became Bishop of Auckland, he purchased 2 acres of land for a cathedral in what is now downtown Auckland and built a small church there out of locally quarried scoria. 30 years later, in 1844, the building was reconstructed and opened as a cathedral dedicated to St. Patrick. One finds as well that the local feasts listed in some missals included March 17 as first class, not as patron of the diocese, but simply as patron of Ireland. Similarly, other Irish feasts, like that of St. Brigid, found their way into the local calendar, though no Maori, no Marist, nor Monsignor Pampalier had any notable devotion to the cache of Irish saints, powerful as they are. The Irish influx also grew political and drew the church into several political fights in the later 19th and early 20th centuries. Famous among these conflicts was a St. Patrick's Day address Monsignor James Liston, coadjutor bishop of Auckland, gave in 1922 on the Irish fight against the British. In it, he described Irish rebels as having been murdered by foreign troops, i.e. the British. The Crown put him on trial for sedition. An all-Protestant jury found him not guilty. The Irish Catholics brought their own culture and customs, which in large part pushed out the Maori Catholic customs that the Maris and Pampalier had helped to develop. The two cultures were wildly different, with only a common faith uniting them. Thus, Maori art and carvings, which to European eyes appeared somewhat pagan and unintelligible, were shunned by the immigrants. In the Auckland Museum, for instance, sits a carved Madonna, but in a form that an Irish priest, upon being offered it by Pacharamu Tematea, found it so offensive he refused to accept it. Richly symbolic, the Virgin in Maori symbolism bears a full facial mako, or tattoo, which no women wear except Anariki Taparu, the firstborn daughter in the family of a high chief. Such a one would be forbidden to marry or be touched, considered tapu or sacred, a kind of consecrated virgin. When the Education Ordinance Act, 1847, was passed, it established English as the normal language of schools. Later, the Native Schools Act of 1867 required instruction for Maori students in English where practicable. While neither law made te reo Maori use illegal, by the late 19th century, most schools banned the language, including many Catholic schools, and caning or strapping awaited those caught speaking the language. This attitude in the wider New Zealand church, established after Pampalier's departure in 1868, did not reflect the principles of the missionaries. While he tried to stay out of politics, Pampalier tried valiantly to intervene and prevent these wars, from which Maori struggled to recover, as their numbers and health had already declined to such an extent that they were not expected to survive as a race. He insisted that the missionaries learn and speak the language, and taught it to them himself, and he lamented his inability in his later years to visit his beloved Maori more due to the excessive demands on his time and poor health. Despite the demographic changes and hibernation of the church, mission stations remained open, particularly under the Mill Hill Fathers, though they slowly lost the support of the hierarchy, which was focused on the growing number of settlers and the anti-native zeitgeist. Next section is Leaving Me Desolate. Monsignor Liston was never the primate of New Zealand, nor even an archbishop. That honor belonged to the Diocese of Wellington and her bishop. Nevertheless, Liston, by dint of longevity in the episcopacy, de facto led the hierarchy. He was ordained a priest at age 23. By the sixth year of his priesthood, he was already rector of the National Seminary in Mosgiel. He was bishop by age 39, and after 16 years as a priest and before turning 50, he would be enthroned in the Cathedral of Auckland in 1929, where he remained ordinary for 41 years. As a late recognition of his silver jubilee as a bishop and the most senior bishop in New Zealand, Pius X awarded him the personal title of archbishop in 1954 at the age of 73. It was clear to historians and faithful that primary focus was always the welfare of the Catholic Church in New Zealand and in the Diocese of Auckland. It was also clear that Liston, though born in Dunedin in the South Island of New Zealand, was an Irishman. His parents were immigrants. He studied in Ireland and in the Irish College in Rome. And his ideal for the New Zealand Church was a microcosm of the continental model and conversion of the barbarians, as happened with the Celts and the Germanic tribes. His relations with the Mill Hill missionaries was, on the surface, cordial, but his actions show he had no interest in keeping the missions alive. It was the antithesis of Pompalier's vision of the work in New Zealand. Liston's priority was assimilation, writes historian Nicholas Reed. His ideal was that, as much as possible, Maori parishioners should be absorbed into the Pekea Church, though perhaps being sometimes addressed in special missions. As such, Liston would modify parish boundaries and close certain places so that the churches became majority non-Maori, and then would remove them from the Mill Hill missionaries and turn the work over to a diocesan priest. From 1931 to 1948, the missionaries were withdrawn from seven different sites. In the closing of the mission at a Maori settlement called Epa, Liston severely rebuked Father Garrett Van Beek for saying Mass in the village, writing, "The good Maoris at the Pa can easily come to the church at Wakatane and have been doing so, as well as taking their proper part in the activities of the parish." When the Maori complained and the Mill Hill fathers tried to accommodate the faithful by offering a monthly Mass on the Marae, Liston forbade this. He also forbade a rosary crusade by the faithful praying for the reopening of the church built on Maori land and which nourished their ancestors. Maori were to worship like other Wakatane parishioners, or perhaps not worship at all. Such actions, for a people deeply connected to their ancestors, the land and sacred places, showed Liston did not understand the Maori. Terribly ironic for an Irishman, tried for sedition over comments about the loss of one of the four green fields. The provincial for the missionaries wrote to the Superior General in 1933 that Liston's policy seemed to be one of slow strangulation of the Maori mission. Meanwhile, Liston was reporting to the apostolic delegate that the missionaries were refusing to learn Maori and were more concerned with the Europeans to explain why he had to close the missions and why the fathers needed to leave. Liston later eased his stranglehold on the missionaries, provided the new missionaries be Irish and not Dutch, as many had been to that point. Father Peter Ryan later would say that Liston didn't really understand what mission meant in the eyes of the church. He didn't understand that to be a missionary meant to understand the faith in their ways and in their language. His ideal was for a Maori to be as like an Irish Catholic as possible. Liston was, theologically speaking, relatively conservative, though his loyalty to the Pope and anticipation of what was coming, despite being uncomfortable with the vernacular Mass, made him quite ahead of Vatican II and the changes it called for. Liston was slow to introduce changes into the liturgy, incensed at the notion of Mass facing the people, and reserved in ecumenical dealings, until he saw Paul VI setting the example, and then he fell into line. Whereas he was slow to allow permission for the Mass or breviary in English before 1967, once it was clear the faithful were expecting this, he capitulated and accelerated the process. But for Liston, the language of the Mass was English, for the same reason as the closure of the missions, integration. In a 1976 survey commissioned by the New Zealand bishops, several notable Maori Catholics lamented the liturgical changes, indicating that because of the English Mass and departure from the Latin they knew, with Maori catechists reading certain prayers in Te Reo Maori, they were no longer attracted to the church or her worship. According to Diane Taylor, traditional Catholic liturgical practices were loved by Maori. Diminution of Catholic tradition inevitably affected some Maori due to their strong sense of tradition. A Maori language Novus Ordo followed, but this was not what Maori were asking for, even if it was a gesture to the emerging zeitgeist of a revival of the language, and the reception of the new vernacular mass was milquetoast. At its peak, the number of Maori priests in New Zealand reached 9 in the 1990s, with one Maori bishop. It has since declined. In the last published census in 2018, Maori composed 16.5% of the population, closely followed by those of Asian descent by immigration, who were 15.1% of the population. There were about 47,000 Maori, 8% of the total, who claimed to be Catholic, almost half of what Pampalier reported within 5 years after his arrival. Further statistics show the impact of Liston's approach, a consistent governmental and societal policy of assimilation, and the decay of what was a rich heritage that was well on its way to being Catholicized. Regular mass attendance of those claiming Catholic heritage, based on statistics from the Diocese of Christchurch, sits at about 10%. In the same 2018 census, 18.5% of Maori, whose culture places great emphasis on their lineage and ancestry, did not know from which tribe they descended. The next section, Ave Atqua Wale. Despite the massive decay of the Catholic Maori, those who kept the faith had great gratitude and love for their Pakipo, as he did for them. Taylor relates several stories in her interviews with Kamatu, or elders, passed down to them, and describes the process by which Maori petitioned to have the mortal remains brought back to New Zealand and placed in the Church of St. Mary's, Motiti, in the Hokanga, near where he first set foot on the shores of New Zealand. In their customary manner, Maori organized a hekoi, or customary pilgrimage, around the country to petition the church and French to exhume the remains of Pampalier and return him to New Zealand. That process resulted in his return in 2002. The welcome was warm and full of Maori customs, as Pampalier himself would have found touching, but there were also signs of the decay. Around 250 firefighters have come from around the North Island and Australia for the Russell Fire Brigade International Game Fish Tournament. The fishermen outnumber the fisher of men, said one reporter. The same journalist stopped at a bar the day before the ceremony, asked the Maori barman about the busy town. The barman had no idea about the arrival of Pampalier's remains, only the fishing tournament. Why have the Catholics and Northern Maori gone to so much trouble to exhume the bishop's bones from his French grave and bring them halfway around the world, he asked. Why bother his rest if his adopted country isn't bothered about him? Father Henner Tate explained, he left, but the mental and spiritual link between the people and him was never severed. Every bishop after him that came to the Hokianga, they were always welcomed with the words, Hamari I Rangu, Etapi Tapi, Apapi Pampare, come in the footsteps of Bishop Pampalier. In other words, the connection was to his person and less to the faith he brought them. The French ambassador, Jackie Mousnier, who came to Russell for that ceremony, confessed to the reporter that until he came to New Zealand, he had never heard of Pampalier. In France, he is forgotten, his honors and reputation buried with him. But as Tate added, in Puteau, no one knows him, so it's better to move him out of that oblivion to where he can be respected, not just the spirit, but the remains. His remains now sit in an 1899-built wooden church, seating about 50 people, St. Mary's Church in Motuti, Hokianga, a bit more than a mile from where Pampalier said the first Mass in New Zealand. Epilogue. Pampalier came ashore and established a thriving mission, subjected to difficulties, mistakes, personality conflicts, and many other very human problems. The work showed tremendous success initially. It is true, as Taylor claims, that the faith never died out, and the memory of that success in Pampalier was preserved, especially among the Maori in the north. Nevertheless, partly because the mission relied on the personality and zeal of one man, partly because it was founded more on active works without a sufficiently supernatural foundation, and partly because the church in New Zealand filled with settlers and the hierarchy changed strategies, the mission eventually failed. Failure is the father of success, provided prudence intervenes. What can be gained for traditional Catholics living in the husk of a civilization that represents today's mission field by looking at the mission to New Zealand and its failure? Firstly, that while one can lament the failures and decay both in New Zealand and the rest of the world, the mission field lies ahead, not behind. The past can teach us lessons for the future, but it is gone and left to the mercy of God, with Providence providing men in a way forward in His grace. The focus must be on the present work, with a view to the future, taking lessons from the past successes and failures. Secondly, the failure of the Church in its mission to the world may have been accelerated by the Second Vatican Council and the liturgical and doctrinal chaos which followed, but as in New Zealand, the decay began well beforehand from a loss of the true apostolic and religious zeal and the substitution of a piety of the feelings, made up exclusively of pious practices and habits, and giving them nothing but vague beliefs, a love without strength, and virtues without deep root. Powerless to open up the wide horizons of Christian life. And that is from Jean-Baptiste Chatard in The Soul of the Apostolate. It is not enough to simply undo Vatican II, but the spirit that brought it about must also be torn out. Thirdly, even zealous and sacrificial missionaries can forget that the spiritual and religious life must be a foundation for any apostolate or life. Contemplation must come before action if a solid foundation will be built. Men, writes St. John of the Cross, would be much more useful to the Church and more pleasing to the Lord, not to mention the good example they would give to those around them, if they devoted more time to prayer and to the exercises of the interior life. That follows for the apostolate of parents within their own families, employees in the workplace, or students in school, just as much as it does for an exterior apostolate or for the religious. Lastly, the Church is not a monoculture. She is Catholic, meant for all people of all times with their varying cultures and norms. The apostle understands that these cultures must be emptied of elements contrary to the faith and good morals, but people cannot be assimilated or forced into a monoculture artificially. When a missionary tries to impose customs or cultural norms that work in one society upon another society that is vastly different, this will impede the work of the apostle. This is even more so when one thinks his own culture more Catholic than the one he is sent to. Such a myopic attempt to bring cultural unity undermines the very goal of bringing souls to the triple bonds of unity that make one a Catholic: unity of worship, doctrine, and authority, not long-established cultural norms. So ends that article. So I thought this was very instructive about what works and what doesn't work in terms of missionary activity. Ora et labora, my friends, prayer and work. If it's just one or if it's just the other, our missionary endeavors, our evangelization efforts are doomed to failure. We need both, and we need to rely ultimately on the grace of Almighty God. So thanks very much to Father Ian Palko of the Society of St. Pius X for that article. I would like to conclude once again by mentioning Helping Autism Through Learning and Outreach, available on the web at halo-soma.org. That's halo-soma.org. Also, please tune into episodes 277 and 548 of the Our Lady of Fatima podcast for more information about Rapid Prompting Method, RPM. RPM has helped non-speakers in a way that sign language helped the deaf, that Braille helped the blind. It has been revolutionary. My niece, before she was 8 years old, we didn't even know her favorite color. Now, thanks to God's grace working through RPM, her hard work, that of her family, we know that she's a comprehensive genius who composes music, poetry, very skilled in mathematics. She even knows foreign languages. What Rapid Prompting Method is doing is taking people out of a prison of silence and getting them into the world of open communication where they belong. Communication is a human right, and it has had that kind of life-changing effect on non-speakers and those with difficulty in speaking. So please get that website and those episodes of the Our Lady of Fatima podcast out there, because if you don't know a non-speaker, you probably will at some point in your life, and this information is invaluable. Thank you once again for listening to the Our Lady of Fatima podcast. Please tune in again next time. Goodbye, and God love you.